Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. I'm your host, Michael Welch. On today's show...
He had been pepper sprayed. He was in segregation during his entire stay at the Central East Correctional Center.
When we mobilized for Seattle, we didn't come from out of nowhere. We were building on so much previous movement experience.
This is all they have. They are living in poverty. The least you could do is give them the decency to clean it up.
But first, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. Forest for the Trees, Reducing Drug and Mental Health Harms in the Inner City of Winnipeg is the title of this year's State of the Inner City report, put out by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives' Manitoba office. The report authors reframe the problems of overdose and addiction to drugs like opioids and crystal meth as stemming from deeper structural problems in our society, such as deep inequality, colonialism, and the failure of government to meet the basic needs of the people experiencing the highest levels of marginalization. Cody Wyoming is a poverty activist and advocate. She was in attendance at the launch of the report on December 11th at the Magnus Eliasson Recreation Center. Her comments reflect the sentiments in the report.
For the last few years with the Conservative government, there's been such a pullback from a welfare state into this neoliberalist society that puts the blame on the individual when really it's systems of oppression that we've been subjected to this whole time.
Proposed recommendations in the report include drug strategies informed by harm reduction and public health principles, taking action to address inequalities, the decolonization of structures, policies, and programs, and sustainable multi-year funding for the community-based organizations providing complementary services to low-income and high-needs populations. The report can be found at the CCPA Manitoba website at policyalternatives.ca/offices/Manitoba. Many thanks to Susan Hubert for providing files for that report. Our next headline comes from CKUT 90.3 FM in so-called Montreal, the traditional and unceded territory of the Ganigahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. On December 3rd, the McGill Board of Governors made public the report on divestment by the Committee to Advise on Matters of Social Responsibility, or CAMSR. The report states that, quote, absolute divestment from the fossil fuel sector is not advisable, unquote, vaguely recommending instead to, quote, reduce the overall carbon emissions of the endowment portfolio, unquote. The recommendations were tabled for approval by McGill's Board of Governors on December 5th in what McGill calls a rushed and illegitimate vote. In protest, Divest McGill, as well as campus and community allies, rallied outside McGill's James Administration Building, coinciding with the Board of Governors' vote on the recommendations. One of the participants in the rally was Karim Habmani, an activist with Climate Justice McGill.
For the third time in a row, the administration of McGill University has decided to disappoint us with a decision that they think that they can fool us with. They think that they can make a decision that is a half effort at creating what we're trying to achieve here, which is divestment. We are able to see their attempt at greenwashing their institution as an institution that is trying to follow the interests of its students, but unfortunately that is not the truth.
Divest McGill is promising to take on more escalation strategies in the next semester. Many thanks to CKUT's Gwendolyn Schumann and Gao Mahadevan for that report. Our next headline comes from Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Senaikst Traditional Territory.
Ottawa's Broadbent Institute has just released its tax index, which provides information and context about Canadians and the tax they pay. Some significant takeaways. The rate of income tax paid by Canada's highest earners has dropped considerably over the last 40 years. In 1980, these earners paid at a 43% rate. This year's rate has dropped to 33%. Canada's corporate income tax has dropped even more significantly over the same period. In 1980, Canada's corporate tax rate was 36%. This year's rate is just 15%. The index calculates the amount of tax revenue lost to tax havens in 2019 as $8 billion, and the yearly tax revenue that could be captured from cracking down on tax evasion as $15 billion. This information and more can be found on the Broadbent Institute's website at broadbentinstitute.ca.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back. Listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. You just heard Winnipeg-based Begonia with the title track of her debut full-length album, Fear. Now it's time for our feature stories. December 15th marked the third anniversary of the death of Soliman Fakiri at the hands of correctional officers in a jail cell in Lindsay, Ontario. 30 demonstrators gathered on McGill's campus to commemorate the life of Soli and to seek justice for those murdered by police. The vigil in Montreal was one of seven held across the country. CKUT's Zosha was on hand to record the audio from the Montreal event.
My name is Irfan Tahiri, and I am a volunteer with the Justice for Soli campaign. December 15th, it's an annual vigil that we use to commemorate the death of Soliman and of all those prisoners who suffer from mental illness and who've died in the prison system. He was admitted into the center on December 4th, 2016. The moment he got in, the family notified the center that he was suffering from schizophrenia, that he required care, a particular type of care. And they were actually trying to move him to a bed at a mental health facility in Whitby, Ontario, which is a nearby city near towards Lindsay. That never happened. The family went to the prison several times throughout the 11-day period from December 4th to December 15th, 2016, requesting to see Soliman. That request was never granted. And then on December 15th, 2016, he was found dead. Moreover, during these 11 days, he was placed in segregation, which is just a fancy way of saying solitary confinement.
Soliman's body had 50 bruises. Both of his legs and hands had been restrained. He had been pepper sprayed. He was in segregation during his entire stay at the Central East Correctional Center. The coroner's report said that his death was unascertained. The first police investigation, which was led by the local police unit, the Kawartha Lakes Police Services, did not press charges against the guards without any explanation. The case was reopened in January 2019 by the Office of the Ontario Chief Coroner after an eyewitness, Mr. John Thibault, to the killing came forward. In the first investigation, the local police closed the case without ever speaking to the eyewitness. The case is now with the Ontario Provincial Police. The Fakiri family are waiting on the police's decision as to whether criminal charges will be pressed against the guards who killed Soliman.
There were 12 white roses who represent the 12 correctional officers who violently killed Soliman.
Adil a travaillé avec des organismes à but non lucratif au Qatar, en Malaisie, en Afrique du Sud et au Canada. De plus, elle écrit fréquemment pour des médias comme The Globe and Mail, Esquire Malaysia, Colors Magazine et Maisonneuve Magazine.
We must uncover our most intimate and ugly prejudices about the mentally ill, the disabled, people of color, women, the poor. Because it is these prejudices, nurtured and tended to in the privacy of our homes, which emerge when we are acting on instinct.
For our collective, caring for social justice, the struggle for health justice cannot be separated from a critique of all systems of domination and oppression. We denounce the lack of access to health in prisons, but also denounce the existence of prisons in and of themselves and the violence that they have within them.
I'm Florence. I'm from the Caring for Social Justice Collective. It's a collective that wants access to health in dignity and care, traditional or alternative care for all. So Sulaiman Fakiri was someone who was who had mental health issues and was incarcerated because there was lacking space in a mental health institution. We think that should never happen, either the fact that there's no place or resources for people who need those resources, and also that the tragic end of violence of the prison system towards someone who is suffering from mental health issues, but any person who suffers from the violence of the prison system too, we want to denounce that.
For those who are listening, but targeting both of those levels of government with an email, you know, towards a member of provincial parliament or an MPP or an MP, I think that would be a first step in spreading the message as well. Yeah, I think those would be my final words to people who are listening.
Thanks to Zosha of CKUT for filing that report. November 30th through December 3rd marked the 20th anniversary of the Battle of Seattle, the 1999 protests by tens of thousands that shut down the World Trade Organization meetings. Chris Dixon, an activist based in Ottawa, was one of the Direction Action Network activists involved in helping to organize those protests, as well as a 20th anniversary website, shutdownwto20.org. This is from an interview with Dixon by Mandy Hiscox of Radio Perg on CFRU.
Some of us who had helped to co-found the Direct Action Network started a conversation earlier this year about the 20th anniversary and about what we might want to do to commemorate that. Even on the left, among activists, there's like lots of very kind of mythologized understandings of what went down there. And part of our perspective is that there are plenty of people who want to tell the story on our behalf. But we thought what we could do was pull together some of the reflections and histories that people who were themselves directly involved in organizing the mass direct action could share. And some of those are ones that people wrote a long time ago, and some of those are ones that people have written very recently. We thought it would be useful to put them all in one place and also try to write out a more detailed history of what the organizing looked like and what the day-to-day protests themselves looked like, trying to sort of put aside many of those myths that circulate around Seattle. And then we also really wanted to talk about looking forward. So not just looking back 20 years, but also looking forward 20 years into the future and thinking about how do we anticipate what's going to occur in the next two decades? How do we plan for it in our movements? And what kinds of movements are on the rise right now, you know, that we can take heart from and that we can actively participate in? Because, yeah, we weren't interested in a project of nostalgia. You know, like, we weren't interested in sort of sitting around and congratulating ourselves as veterans of this one particular episode, because we see ourselves as part of an ongoing struggle, right? Like, you know, I always appreciated the fact that the CLAC in Montreal, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, which was one of the central organizing groups for the protests against the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or the Organization of American States Summit in 2001 in Quebec City, they had this slogan that they used, which was, "It didn't start in Seattle and it won't end in Quebec City." And I think that that really crystallized something that's remained important for us, which is recognizing that when we mobilized for Seattle, we didn't come from out of nowhere. We were building on so much previous movement experience, and it didn't end, right? Like, we're continuing on into various kinds of movements and struggles today that, you know, certainly have changed in form, but I think a lot of the spirit has remained the same. And we really wanted to try and say that these are some of the things that we experienced and learned from Seattle, that can maybe be useful now, and including mistakes. And we also really wanted to foreground some of the brilliant kinds of art that were involved in it, whether that was music, you know, there was you know, there was like an anarchist marching band called the Infernal Noise Brigade that was just brilliant. And so we have some, you know, material up there about that, or some of the like music and video that was produced, particularly through the Seattle Independent Media Center, you know, that was its own, like there's a whole story just to be told about the birth of the Independent Media Center movement in Seattle, and the ways that they, you know, put forward this whole kind of activist journalism approach.
The following is a clip of Jill Friedberg at the Seattle Independent Media Center from the Showdown in Seattle video series produced during the 1999 protests.
We've also started talking about using this model and trying to go elsewhere in the country and the world and help people kind of set up similar centers so that there really could be an alternative media network around the world.
Friedberg went on to produce the documentary about Seattle, This Is What Democracy Looks Like, and the indie media network did go global, including a number of locals in Canada. 20th anniversary of the Seattle 1999 WTO protests were marked with a number of large gatherings internationally. Media activists from Canada presented at the Our Media Conference in Brussels, Belgium. Gretchen King on Indie Media and Sandra Jepson on the Media Action Research Group, and the Indie Media 20th Anniversary Encuentro in Houston, Texas. The website, produced by Direction Action Network members and GAIN, is at shutdownwto20.org. Thanks to Greg McDougall of equitableeducation.ca in Ottawa on unceded Algonquin territory, and to Mandy Hiscox of CFRU in Guelph on the traditional territory of the Neutral Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and Métis peoples for providing files for that report. On Tuesday, December 10th, two Quebec-based housing rights groups, Front d'Action Populaire en Réaménagement Urbain, or FAPRU, and Réseau Solidarité Itinérance du Québec, organized a march in Ottawa to demand the federal government increase resources for addressing homelessness and the housing crisis. The march started just after 1 p.m. at Confederation Park and ended at the Prime Minister's office. Laurie Bacro is the coordinator of Réseau Solidarité Itinérance du Québec, a Quebec homelessness solidarity network. She explains the urgency of addressing the homelessness crisis that motivated this action.
Occupancy rates are exploding everywhere in Quebec and Canada. There is between 98% and 99% rates in many cities, and the situation is becoming really worrying. Average rents are becoming more and more expensive. There are improvised camps which are sprouting up everywhere. We talk about 10 cities in Ottawa, but there were two temporary camps in Gatineau. And actually, it's a phenomenon that is found everywhere. For the situation, we can see an overflow in emergency accommodation, and shelter resources as to refuse people. The refusal rate of organizations due to lack of space are really worrying. Everywhere in Canada, in Vancouver, in Ottawa, and in Montreal, in many cities, refusal keeps increasing year after year, placing resources in a situation of permanent crisis. There is 35,000 annual refusals which are counted. And it's the same situation in Quebec City, in Sherbrooke, in Gatineau. Request the new Trudeau government that the budget reaching home, which is the federal program to combat homelessness, plan from 2021, be increased to a minimum of 15 million per year in Quebec, without imposing any direction, in order to allow the creation of new services and the improvement of existing ones in all regions of Quebec. And the two networks are asking $2 billion per year for Canada to face with the housing crisis and for the construction of new social housing.
The march took place on the same day that a homeless camp known as Tent City and the belongings of all its residents were bulldozed by employees of the National Capital Commission under the supervision of the Ottawa Police Service. The occupants had believed they had an additional 24 hours to clear out and accepted lodgings in hotels in Vanier in the interim. But while the residents had left, the bulldozers came on the scene and commenced with the destruction of the camp. Leila Attar, advocate and member of Overdose Prevention Ottawa, was on the scene as the demolition was taking place. Here is some audio of her pleading with the workers for more time to clean up the site.
The idea is to kind of get it cleaned up today. So,
like, their friends, they just died. Like, they have nothing. This is their entire life. Just give them 12 hours to clean it up. They're moving along. Come on, guys.
Who's here remaining that has stuff here? Like, did you say that?
All the residents thought they had, like, 48 hours to clean up, so they moved to Vanier, okay, thinking they could come back today and clean it up. Here we are, awoken at, like, 7 a.m. to that this is happening right now. So, like, have the decency to let these guys, give them 12 hours to come clean up their shit. Like, this is their home. This is all they have. They are living in poverty. The least you could do is give them the decency to clean it up. It's just, they're human beings, you know? So please send that back to Toby and whoever else is sending this message down, and we are going to do our best to clean it up, because this is cruel. This is cruel. Thank you.
Lori Bakro notes that an interesting exchange on the housing crisis was taking place in the House of Commons at the same time as activists were mobilizing in the streets.
So at the same time as the demonstrator ran the street, where in front of the parliament, Denis Trudel called out Anna Duquen, who's the federal minister for families, children and social development. The response of Anna Duquen, who was forced to respond to Trudel's second inquiry on the issue of homelessness, speak volume. He spoke only of chronic homelessness in Canada, demonstrating to the Quebec Member of Parliament his complete lack of knowledge about the fight against homelessness in Quebec and of the Canada-Quebec agreement signed in September.
Listeners interested in getting more information about the crisis and how they could help can consult the site rsiq.net or visit the Facebook page for Raison Solidarité Itinérance du Québec. Many thanks to Greg McDougall of equitableeducation.ca and to Leila Attar for supplying her recorded audio. You're still listening to Groundwire Community News, broadcasting from coast to coast to coast and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our community radio report. Winnipeg community radio station CJNU, Nostalgia Radio, is hosting the upcoming Station Managers Summit. The two-day gathering of station heads will offer guided conversations and presentations on selected topics, while also offering room for station reps to bring their own concerns to the floor. Barry Rook is the executive director of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. He provides some background on the summit.
About 7 or 8 years ago, a handful of NCRA member stations got together and decided it would be a really good idea to bring some of the heads of the station together, those individuals that are either a station manager or on the board of directors or a key volunteer for those that don't have staff, to come and talk about really station-oriented ideas. So not necessarily about the specifics that the staff are doing or so on, but more the management of the station as a whole. So our members organized that for about 3 or so years, and then it dropped off because, well, stations are busy and it's tough to do it. So 3 years ago, the NCRA took up the idea from the office here and has hosted a couple of these with our partner radio stations. So we first did the one at CHRY in Toronto. Last year we were at CITR in Vancouver, and then this year we'll be at CJNU, which is the community radio station, seniors-focused station, that actually jumps around the city with a mobile broadcast studio. So it doesn't really have a home studio, though they have offices. They broadcast out of different spaces. We're hoping that there's going to be about 20 to 30 stations represented and being able to participate not only in the accessibility training that's being done there, but also the rest of the discussion that's happening amongst those station managers that were really there just to facilitate the different topics that they want to talk about.
And what are the key topics coming up this year?
Well, we've had some interesting discussions specifically around cannabis and advertising. There's always topics that pop up around management of radio stations, specifically working with a board of directors, looking at grant funding opportunities, HR-related issues when it comes to staff and their ability to complete tasks and projects. So those are some of them. We're also looking at accessibility related to hiring practices and what are some of the best ways and able to be able to accommodate for and actually look for people who may have disabilities to better participate in the radio stations. So there's a mix of all those different groups. We also have the human rights, one of the head from human rights participating there, and a former MP is going to also speak a little bit about the changing in technology and the way that that's impacted radio stations from the government perspective as well. So there's a handful of different guests, whether they're giving proper or official training opportunities, or they're coming in to speak and spark a discussion, which we can then continue on within the group that's there.
You mentioned CJNU in Winnipeg as the host station this year. What are your thoughts about that choice? Are there any advantages or benefits to having it there?
Well, one of the advantages that we have there is the president of the NCRA is based out of that station, so it was a bit of ease to be able to find a spot that would be accessible for many people, would be able to try to keep costs down as much as possible, and because they have access to rooms and facilities that are not as expensive, or in this case, we've been able to get them for no cost.
Adam Glynn is the station manager at CJNU and currently serves as the president of the board of the NCRA. In an email to Groundwire, he commented on the upcoming Station Managers Summit as follows. The annual summit is a perfect venue for celebrating the successes of our sector and grappling with the challenges we collectively face on a micro level in the communities we serve and on a macro level as we work hard nationally to be a strong third pillar of the Canadian broadcasting system alongside public and commercial broadcasters. Specifically, the 2020 summit is an amazing opportunity to showcase our community here in Winnipeg. For a city of our size, we are incredibly diverse with people from all over the world calling Winnipeg home. We are also so lucky to have four strong campus and community radio stations in our city, amplifying voices and telling stories. The summit takes place January 18th and 19th. For details on accommodations while in town and other aspects of the summit, please email luke@ncra.ca. That was our community radio report. Up next, a short musical break.
When I was 17, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for small town girls and soft summer nights. We'd hide from the light on the village green when I was 17.
We just heard the Sky Diggers with their cover of It Was a Very Good Year from the album Let's Get Friendship Right. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiyawak and the Dakota. Headlines this week were written by Michael Welch, Gal Mahadevan, and Catherine Fisher. We also thank Susan Hubert, Greg McDougall, Zoe, and Mandy Hiscox for their contributions. Music this week was by Begonia and the Sky Diggers. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.